Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the HMEB podcast. I'm your host, David Cuff, the executive editor of HME Business Magazine, your source for news, trends, and insights into the home medical equipment industry. For several years, providers have been on a quest for new funding sources, and I thought it would be a good idea to talk to a key industry expert about one of those sources in particular. So I'm here speaking with Jeff Baird. He's the chair of Brown & Fortunato's National Healthcare Group. Most providers in the industry know that group works on behalf of various healthcare clients, including HME providers. And we're talking about negotiating Medicare managed care contracts. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, David. It's good to hear your voice. Good to visit with you. And I always enjoy seeing you at the Med Trades.
All right. Well, the feeling is likewise, Jeff. Okay, so what is the issue that providers are encountering when it comes to managed care contracts?
You bet. Good question. We as an industry, as a DME industry, we've been for decades, a fee-for-service industry, meaning that over the past 30, 40 years, all we did was bill Medicare fee-for-service, Medicaid fee-for-service. Well, that's changed over the last 10 years or so, where increasingly Medicare and the state Medicaid programs are shifting to managed care. And all that means is that, for example, let's just use a state Medicaid program. It will go out and contract with a number of plans. These plans then are the go-between, the middleman, if you will, between the Medicaid program and the hospital or doctor, or in our case, a DME supplier.
Uh-huh. Do they function in the same way?
Medicaid managed care or Medicare Advantage, they're basically the same thing, function pretty much the same way, except that all a Medicare Advantage plan is just essentially a contract between an insurance company and Medicare. Likewise, all a Medicaid managed care plan is a contract between an insurance company and the state Medicaid program. And so the coverage and reimbursement guidelines and audit guidelines and all of that are set by whoever owns the plan, which might be Centene or Humana or Aetna or something like that. In other words, it's not the Medicare program itself or the state Medicaid program itself that sets all these requirements. It's the plan itself, which is owned by the insurance company.
Gotcha. And I'm curious, because this is being outsourced, are they still functioning similarly to how, say, CMS would manage this program? Or is it different?
I'm somewhat critical, and in my opinion, it's different. We all know that government, by its very nature, is inefficient. That's part of being government. At the same time, whether it's a state Medicaid program or whether it's Medicare, there's not a profit motive. They're not trying to earn a profit, but rather they're just trying to take care of patients best they can within a certain budget. That's not the case with Medicaid or managed care plans or Medicare Advantage plans, because these are for-profit insurance companies, and what they want to do is get as much money as possible from the Medicare or Medicaid program, pay as little as possible to doctors and hospitals and DME suppliers, and pocket the difference. And so they can profit pocket the profit. It's kind of a tongue twister here.
Yeah.
The problem then is that you call it the least common denominator, where you'll have a plan that will really try to ratchet down reimbursement, drive out a number of the quality providers or suppliers, and at the end of the day, the quality of product and quality of service might very well decrease.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how does the provider fit into this equation when they're working with these contractors?
Well, again, that's a challenge, because let's say you have we'll just use the great state of Texas where I'm from. If you might have a DME supplier down in Abilene, let's say, and it is servicing a whole bunch of customers it's had for years and years and years, whether it's Superior Health, which is a Centene plan, or a Humana plan, or Aetna plan, comes in and scoops up a bunch of those patients there in the Abilene area. And if that DME supplier, is not been able to sign that contract with the plan, has not been able to sign the plan contract with Centene or Humana or Aetna. In other words, it's a closed plan. Then all of a sudden, the DME supplier is on the outs, and it has just lost a whole bunch of its patients because its former patients that it used to deal with now are covered by a plan for which the DME supplier doesn't have a contract, mm-hmm. and that is a real challenge.
And what about the contracts themselves? Are they open to negotiation at all?
To a point, it's an urban legend where a lot of DME suppliers feel like these contracts are take it or leave it. That's not necessarily the case. There are certain areas of the contract that can be negotiated, and as to the ability of the DME supplier to truly negotiate, it depends on how strong its bargaining position is. For example, the DME supplier is the big gun, the top gun there in Abilene, where that DME supplier is really needed, then it can have more heft in terms of negotiating than somebody else. Mm-hmm. But it's like in high school when you want to ask out the prom queen, the worst that's going to happen is that she's going to say no to you.
Yeah.
Well, likewise here, it's in the best interest of the DME supplier to go on ahead and try to negotiate certain points in the contract. The worst that's going to happen is that the plan is going to say, no, we're not interested in doing that. But what we have found is that we have seen some flexibility with these insurance companies that are willing to negotiate certain provisions.
Gotcha. For a definition of terms, I in discussions earlier, you had mentioned that there are panels. What are the panels in this relationship?
All a panel, when I say a panel, let's say, again, here in Texas, so if Superior Health or Superior Care, I forgot what it's called, but if, say, that particular Centene plan, it's going to go out and let's say it contracts with 12 DME suppliers in the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
They constitute the DME panel for that particular plan. Likewise, if the Superior Health plan goes out and contracts with, say, 100 doctors, and then those 100 doctors constitute the physician panel for that plan. That's all a panel is.
And so the number of providers on a panel can be limited.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. That's where it gets to be real challenging for DME suppliers and for other providers, for that matter, because the plan is given authority, whether it's by the state or by the Medicare program, to limit the number of providers and suppliers that it has on its panels. And so if the DME supplier down in Abilene is not accepted onto the contract, that is, the plan says, we don't need you, we have enough, then all of a sudden, you know, it's out in the cold, and that's a real challenge.
Gotcha. Are there any kind of ways out for the provider to get on that panel?
It's an uphill fight, but there are, and I wish there was a magic bullet. There's not. However, having said that, there are some steps that the DME supplier can take. The first one, which is the low-hanging fruit, is to see if that particular state has what's called an any willing provider statute or law. And all that says is that any provider or supplier that's willing to accept the reimbursement has to be accepted onto a panel. Well, a number of states have those any willing provider statutes, but they do not extend to DME suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth the ask. Let's just see. Then secondly, the DME supplier can go and can look at the state Medicaid regulations to see if under the state law, for example, does the plan have the right to limit the number of providers and suppliers. Usually they do, but sometimes they don't. So again, that's worth the ask. And then number three, the supplier has a good relationship with the local hospital or local large physician group that's on the plan, then the DME supplier can say to them, will you please go and advocate for me? Please go talk to the plan. Tell the plan that my DME company really needs to be on the plan, needs to be on the panel because of how good we are. That's number three. And then number four, David, which is sounds awfully cliche-ish, but it's really true, and that is under the title of the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I've seen clients that have just been relentless in terms of contacting, calling the plan every month or every 2 weeks and say, is there a place for me now? Is there a place for me now? And sometimes the plan will just say, oh, what the hell? Yes.
You know, I just want to say for the for everybody in the audience, we're recording this interview on Valentine's Day. And this is just it's so apropos.
Yeah. And then, but that, you know, and you, and they'll just relent and let them on. So those are the, those are some of the steps that can be taken.
That's great. Well, okay. So let's say a provider is in this relationship now. how does the nature of the relationship work? In other words, are audits handled through the contractor, that kind of stuff? How are claims submitted? What are some key kind of bullet points in the
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. What happens, let's use a state Medicaid program as an example. Mm-hmm. So the state Medicaid program will say, let's use Illinois, Illini Care, that's a Centene plan in Illinois. So the Illinois Medicaid program will say to Centene, okay, this is your plan. We see that you've scooped up hundreds of thousands of Medicaid beneficiaries in the state. You go do your thing. Just don't mess up. Go do your thing. Take care of these folks. And so then what happens is the reimbursement amount is set by Illini Care. Or maybe it can be negotiated between the DME supplier and Illini Care. The ability to audit, that's set out in the contract between the DME supplier and Illini Care. The definition of what medical necessity is, that's set out in the contract between Illini Care and the DME supplier, so on and so forth. Now, everybody needs to be aware of is these contracts are not that long. They might be 15, 20 pages long, but what will happen is, for example, the Illini Care contract with Fred's DME in Decatur, Illinois, what it likely says is, oh, by the way, in addition to all the provisions in the 15 pages of this contract also incorporates by reference all of the Illini Care policies and procedures that Illini Care puts out there from time to time and that Illini Care amends from time to time. So all of a sudden, excuse me, this 15-page contract, if you really incorporate all this outside stuff in, is now a 300-page contract.
Wow. Yeah. So the relationship and the ways it's carried out can be pretty intricate. What if providers want to learn more, Jeff? Are you got any speaking engagements coming up?
Absolutely. And I tell you what I've got, which I can send to you, Dave, if you ask me to. I've got a four-part series of articles on negotiating managed care contracts. And if you want to distribute these out or put them on your website, however you want to do it, it's fine with me. But in addition to that, I'm putting on a home care webinar on March 26th on prospective oxygen patients and free pre-screens and free use of equipment and other problem areas as far as oxygen is concerned. I'm also speaking multiple times at MedTrade Spring in Vegas in mid-April. And then I'm also putting on a webinar for a home care on April 30th entitled when it's proper to restart the 36-month oxygen rental period. These are just a few examples of things coming up.
Wow, thanks, Jeff. All right, well, I appreciate you taking the time, and we'll definitely get that series of articles online for the readers. Again, Jeff, thank you very much for your time and your information.
Absolutely, David. Anytime, we love working with you and your team, and education is important, so anytime you want me to come back on, just ask. I'll be there.
All right. We definitely will. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, David.
And I should add that Jeff did make good on his promise. We have the four-part series and have already published the first installment at hme-business.com. If you go to the site, again, that's hme-business.com, and you look at the latest features section, you will see Jeff's first installment at the top of the list. That was published on February 21st, and the next installments will go live February 28th, March 7th, and March 14th. Jeff, thank you very much for this contribution. I know it's going to help a lot of providers, a lot of the readers out there, so thank you very much. Of course, there are a multiplicity of revenue opportunities besides managed care contracts, and one of them also represents a fundamental patient care category as well. I'm talking about women's health, and I am speaking with a key advocate and expert in that regard, Nikki Jensen. Nikki is the vice president of Essentially Women, the division of VGM Group that is focused on women's health. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. I guess the a good place to start would be to learn a little bit more about Essentially Women. Could you tell me more about the group and what it provides in the industry?
Absolutely. Essentially Women has been a member service organization that's been around for about 23 years. VGM acquired Essentially Women about 3 years ago, so it was January 1st of 2016. But the intent of the Essentially Women organization has always been to provide a network, a member service organization for ancillary providers in the space of women's health. Many of those have been in regards to post-mastectomy providers, but with the Affordable Care Act that changed the distribution of breast pumps and such, it has been more broadly, phased as women's health with the addition of the mother-baby space as well. Our belief and our intent is that a lot of these are independently owned providers, community-based, and a lot of them really need some assistance when it comes to the back end of their organization. Mm-hmm. Most people get into business to service the customers and the patients in their community. Nobody really gets into business because they think it's really fun to bill insurance companies and Medicare and all of those other things that go along with it, that if they would have known what they know now, it would have, maybe it would have changed things. But our intent is really to help people on that backside so they can put a lot more effort forward and doing the things that they might perceive as being the more glamorous side of their business, and that is the helping of the patients in their communities.
Certainly where their expertise lies, that's for sure. And you guys just wrapped up an event, the Focus Show. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that and what were some of the highlights?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Focus Conference is absolutely our favorite time of year because with our Essentially Women staff here that we have in Waterloo, Iowa, we get an opportunity to communicate with our members across the country via email and phone, but we really get to see everybody and interact with people and network along with our participating vendors and vendor friends that we have throughout the community when we get together at Focus. So that event was held last week. It was February 2nd through the 4th in St. Pete Beach, Florida, which who doesn't want to go to Florida in February?
Yeah.
Those of us who live in the Midwest, we were all jumping on board for that one.
I bet.
But we had a great experience. We heard from our members and our vendors all in sync with telling us that the positive vibe and the energy was something they could all feel. Many of them told us they thought it was the best Focus we've had yet, which obviously that's our goal every year, is to go over and above the experience that our members and our vendors have year over year. So it was all in all a great experience.
All right. Well, let's transition back to women's health as a sort of a broader topic. Why is women's health important in this sector? Obviously women make up 50% of the population, right? So, I mean, that should be a no-brainer, especially given that they have, specific healthcare needs like post-mastectomy care and the things you described. Why is it important, and are providers recognizing that importance, if you had to, take a hot take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most important things about this is that it is very much a community-based experience that people have, that they want to be able to go to somebody within their community and You know, if they're looking for compression garments, if they're looking for breast prosthesis mastectomy bras, it's not something that's very easily purchased, you know, on the internet, so to speak. It's something that people like to be personally fitted. They like to have an experience of going into a warm and inviting environment, to have somebody that they can talk to and ask questions and be fitted personally, because it is such an intimate experience. And understanding that for a lot of women who have experienced breast cancer, you know, they've had that clinical, medical experience, and now they're really ready to go into somewhere that has that warm, inviting environment and somebody that's willing to listen to them and understand what they're going through. Mm-hmm. But also to understand that in addition to the items that are billed to insurance, there's also an abundance of items that are retail that are going to help a woman through her recovery process following mastectomy surgery. So it's, you know, it's something that is immediate right after surgery, but there's also the ongoing relationship that you're going to have with a woman who's experienced breast cancer as well.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And it's not just, breast cancer as well. There's gotta be other needs. A couple that would probably jump to mind would be, the specific sleep needs of women or specific incontinence needs. There are a whole host of other products, correct?
Absolutely. From, you said it right on the nail on the head, there's incontinence, there's the maternity side of things, there's apparel when it comes to, you know, nursing bras and nursing pads, and then when it comes to the, you know, compression garments for women right after surgery, and then when it comes to lymphedema, because there's such a high incidence and a high rate of lymphedema in this patient population, specifically, that there's, you know, all of the, everything that revolves around lymphedema is also segmented in there. But you've also got footwear, you've got diabetic shoes, you've got the socks and accessories, you know, compression stockings, and then headwear when it comes to the wigs and hair pieces, the scarves, things along those lines, and then also skincare. So for a lot of women who have experienced maybe radiation treatment, any kind of cancers or chemotherapy, they are experiencing more sensitive skin. So they're looking for different lines of skincare and treatment, or shampoos and such. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, promotional items. There's the things that people are going to buy, not only if they're the patient themselves, but the family members, for those people as well. But then also when it comes to loungewear and sleepwear, swimwear is also included in there.
Oh, yeah.
And then for the post-surgical, you know, those things that people are going to need, those post-surgical items, you know, whether it's cushions, accessories to help people get in and out of a chair, in and out of bed, because following a mastectomy surgery specifically, they're not going to be able to use their arms right away.
Gotcha.
So there's a whole host of items that kind of fall within there, that are going to impact women specifically.
Gotcha. So a provider who might be listening to this and going, you know, oh, you know, light bulb goes off, they say, yeah, this is something I need to start doing a better job of addressing. How can they get started?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some things that you don't have to be certified for. So certainly, you know, selling, you know, some of those retail type items and so post-surgical items that you don't have to be certified for. But if you are looking to bill insurance companies for breast prosthesis, then you're going to need to have a mastectomy fitter on staff. I would say probably we're about a 50-50 split within our organization as to those that use ABC and those that use BOC. Those are the common ones that we see as far as the certifying bodies and the accrediting bodies for that. And then for compression garments as well, you know, you're going to need somebody that's going to know how to fit compression garments. And for most cases, you're going to be able to find support for those within the manufacturers. The manufacturers on the breast prosthesis side of things also offer education and resources for that as well.
Okay, so obviously there's a big learning curve. How can providers find out more information if they want to dive in?
If they're looking for specific information, they can contact us directly. They can go to essentiallywomen.com and either fill out a contact form to contact us or contact us at our toll-free number, which is 800-988-4484. And we can certainly put you in the right direction. A lot of the manufacturers offer classes in different parts of the country throughout the year. So sometimes it's a matter of just getting in touch with the manufacturers and finding out when they're going to be in your area. Otherwise, if we can help connect you for any specific needs, we can certainly get you pointed in the right direction.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing some time and expertise.
All right. Thank you.
And I should add, that's not the last you'll be hearing from Nikki. There's important legislation coming down the pike for women's health providers and their patients concerning post-mastectomy care, and I'll be having a conversation with her about that soon. Okay, well, remember, if you want to stay on top of what's happening in the industry, make sure to check out hme-business.com and subscribe to our eSource weekly e-newsletter service. And if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to the print magazine on our website as well. Again, our site is hme-business.com. And of course, you can follow HME Business online via social media. We're at HME Business on both Facebook and Twitter, and I'm at Post Acute News on Twitter. And of course, there's this podcast. Please, if you haven't done so already, make sure to click the subscribe button so that you can get every new episode. Remember, you keep listening and we'll keep posting. Okay, I think we'll wrap things up for this episode. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, don't be afraid to reach out to me via Twitter. Again, that's at Post Acute News, or you can always reach me by email at dkopf@1105media.com. Thank you all very much for listening, and goodbye until the next HMEB podcast.